800, 801, 802, and 809 relating to limited scope representation. The presenter will be Judge John P. Anderson, Circuit Court Judge, Bayfield County. Judge Anderson.
Thank you and good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Very good to be here again. I hope you are not getting tired of my presence twice in 1 month. Justices, as you know, I'm here on behalf of PPAC's Limited Scope Representation Committee, which was formed 4 years ago now to tackle the issue of the rule in Wisconsin regarding limited scope representation. Now, Wisconsin is one of 42 states which allow limited scope representation. Wisconsin adopted their rule several years ago, essentially adopting the ABA's model rule, and that is in 20:1.2. I would like to say that after 4 years of going through two phases of analysis, the first phase was whether or not it was feasible to revamp the rules, and the second phase was to actually create a proposal to this court to take a look at. I'm happy to report that we have completed the task given to us by PPAC. I have asked the marshal to provide you with a list of all the members that worked on both phase one and phase two. And I think you can see from the people who worked on this that it was a nice cross-section of both people within the profession and outside of the profession. And they've worked extremely hard, and we've gone through an enormous amount of material to get to where we are today. I want to say it was an honor for me to work with each and every one of them. Now, our existing rule, by its very nature, gives a great deal of latitude to attorneys and clients to fashion a situation in which an attorney can provide limited scope representation. However, by its very nature, being somewhat broad and undefined, it leaves a certain degree of ambiguity as to what is reasonable and a certain degree of ambiguity as to how to actually fashion a limited scope representation, particularly.
Judge Anderson, it sounds to me like something that's to be left in the sound discretion of our trial courts, and each judge is within the framework of the proposal, if it's adopted, will simply fashion the details to implement the rule as fits the culture of the county as well as the law. Is that about right?
As to the existing rule or our proposal?
Your proposal.
Well, I think that's probably true. Every county and every legal culture has its own little nuances about, when they're going to file appearances and things such as that.
And if it turns out that certain parts are unworkable in a particular county, the circuit court judge is free to use his or her sound discretion to implement as they see fit within the bounds of the rule, of the proposal.
I think that would be fair to say that.
But we're going to have uniform. Aren't we going to have a uniform assignment sheet? What does the Appendix A say? That's going to be a uniform notice and consent to limit. I mean, you've got an Appendix A. PPAC developed it, but I thought that the rule provided that records management, I don't know if it's the management committee, but whatever the records committee is that makes up our form is going to ultimately have a form. I thought that's what it said. I thought the concept of this is that you want enough procedure in this rule so that lawyers are comfortable in what they are going to do. and that there's a deal, an agreement that's, for the most part, in writing, with exceptions, in writing, so that the lawyer and the client agree on what the lawyer is going to do, so that later on the client doesn't say, oh, you said you'd handle it all the way, and the lawyer understands what his or her experiences are. And one of the problems in the draft that some people see is that the judge has discretion to say to the lawyer, you're going to have to do more than this limited scope representation agreement is.
Well, I think, you know, I think we try to address that by making it fairly clear how the lawyer is allowed to withdraw from the limited scope representation.
Does the lawyer have to give notice?
There is a notice.
Good.
You have to give notice.
Okay.
There's the notice. You know, unlike, we don't have any particular requirement right now that there's a formal notice of appearance in a normal case. In a limited scope, you're going to be giving a formal notice to the court that there is a limited scope representation occurring and what that's going to be, and then when that representation comes to an end, you're going to be notifying the court and the parties involved that that limited scope representation has now come to an end, so that everyone is aware of the parameters of it.
I understand that, but suppose you don't, not everybody goes to court. You know, you see a lawyer and you want advice. One, you want information, maybe, and that's different than advice, if I read this properly. So you want advice, and then your advice might be that negotiating with the other side or the government, whatever it is, that it will be settled. Now, do you have to give notice then of limited representation, or is this only in court?
The notice of a limited representation occurrence is only if there's a matter pending before the court.
Okay.
The informed consent in writing deals with both aspects, non-litigation and litigation. And that, of course, is one of the first issues that we addressed is should there be an informed consent in writing, and our recommendation is yes under these circumstances.
Now, is that Appendix A that I keep?
We've given you Appendix A.
Right.
And of course, this is, we like the idea of forms. We must say that. We have given Appendix A as a suggestion as to what an informed consent agreement may look like. We're not necessarily suggesting that this is the best one. We're not suggesting you would necessarily adopt it. We're suggesting we like it, and we suggest that there should be, perhaps, some suggested forms to use along those lines. I know that when I practice law, I always looked for good forms to use before I started drafting one from scratch. So I think these Appendix A is an example of something that would be quite helpful when an attorney and a client want to enter into a limited scope representation.
1G proposed amendment to 20:1.2C5 states the Office of the Director of State Courts shall provide forms for the use in filing a notice of limited appearances and notice of termination of limited appearance.
Yes.
Okay. If the court adopts these rule amendments, I think this comes from your memo, the criteria stated in the rules would assist the Wisconsin Court Records Management Committee. That's the one I was talking about. Sorry, I didn't get the name right. In its development of the court forms. That's on, I think, page 17 of your memorandum. Nope, that's on page 17 of my memorandum, but it relates to you.
Your Honor.
Yes.
I know that the ABA has a model rule that's referred to. I know that we already have a Supreme Court rule that provides for limited scope representation. I know that 42 states have responded to the apparent need for limited scope representation. My question is, how does this rule that you're proposing, or the modifications to the rules, how does this petition compared with that which is espoused by the ABA or other jurisdictions?
Well, 42 states allow limited scope representation. 24 of those states have expanded the ABA model rule in many of the ways that we're asking you to expand it here today, both from an ethical standpoint and from a civil procedure standpoint. So over half of the 42 have, in fact, done what we are doing here in one manner or another. In fact, we pored over those 24 states and to look at what they did, and we adopted what we thought were some of the best ideas from the 24 states that would work well in Wisconsin. So what we're proposing here would be substantially in line with most of the states that have adopted a limited scope representation process.
Counselor, I have a question for you, Judge, and the question is, what about a representation that is limited to administrative hearings? And let me give you an example. When I was in private practice, my pro bono work for my firm was to represent chronically mentally ill women to just get them SSI, because often they lived on the street because they just didn't have any income. And with SSI, they could live in subsidized housing. How does this fit with the and all I did was go before the administrative agency, usually as far as an administrative law judge, and once someone could present their facts and circumstances in a understandable fashion, you know, I had very good success for that. How would that come into the rules as you envision them? We always had in my law firm a requirement that every representation was in writing, so those representations, you know, had a written statement about what I was going to try to do on their behalf. But how does that fit in with the rule you propose?
Well, it would fit in within the confines of the Supreme Court rules. I don't think it would necessarily apply to any of the statutory creations or amendments we're asking you to do in 800, 801, 802.
Okay, so you don't see that there needs to be any involvement of any kind of a judicial personnel for administrating hearings, even if you go before an administrative law judge or whatever?
We certainly did not contemplate this rule affecting procedures within an administrative proceeding. It would, however, affect the underlying limited scope representation agreement that you would have and all the rules that would go along with that within the Supreme Court rules, the ethics rules involving the informed consent be in writing, the scope of it.
This governs the lawyer. It does not govern the proceedings.
For administrative, yes, absolutely.
Well, that's an executive branch.
Right.
Okay. The question rose in my mind when I looked at your 20:1.2c2, and it says this is when you have an agreement in writing, which is the process I'm familiar with, though there may be other processes. If the client gives informed consent in writing signed by the client, there shall be a presumption that the representation is limited to the lawyer and the services described, and the lawyer does not represent the client generally or in matters other than those described in writing. And once in a while, I would also help them try to find a place to live once they got SSI. Would that be contrary to what I should have been doing under these rules?
Well, I mean, there's always going to be situations where there may be some collateral matters which an attorney may be helping a client with.
Okay.
And we certainly weren't of the opinion that we would want to limit that in any respect.
And
I think that those types of activities, while they may be, you know, quasi-legal assistance and sometimes just plain old practical help for someone that needs some help, and the lawyer actually knows, well, you should probably call this person if housing isn't needed, or you should call this department if you need some food assistance or heating assistance. And I don't think our rules contemplate affecting that in any way, and I really can't imagine attorneys having to go back and amending their limited scope representation agreements if they provide that extra service. Okay. It does provide a presumption that it's limited to that.
Right.
But it doesn't necessarily mean that you can't go above and beyond that for collateral matters that may be necessary under the circumstances. And I can't imagine there would be a significant harm to an attorney or any ethical problem if they did that.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Judge, I don't really understand when exactly what triggers limited scope representation. When does it start? When do the rules come into play?
Well, of course, it exists right now. And of course, when we see it periodically within the profession, but are you asking for like an example of?
I don't think I understand when an attorney begins to come under the rules.
Okay.
For example, if someone comes to an attorney's office and they haven't entered into an agreement yet, and in fact the attorney is not sure that there is anything that could be litigated, but the attorney gives advice of what the person should do. Does that involve? What happens in that situation?
The same rule we think would apply that applies right now. If someone comes in for a consultation and the lawyer gives them some general advice, but no attorney-client relationship is entered into after that initial consultation. It just simply comes to an end. The attorney gives some information, advice, but there is no attorney-client relationship. The limited scope representation doesn't kick in either. It's only when the attorney and the client, the lawyer and the client, reach some type of understanding that the lawyer is going to do something for them above and beyond just that initial consultation. I don't think our rule contemplates changing initial consultations, which is obviously the starting point. It's either going to be the starting point of an attorney-client relationship, or it's going to be not the starting point of an attorney-client relationship. The attorney-client relationship either exists in a limited basis or it exists in something beyond a limited basis.
Well, maybe when one of the lawyers comes up, especially someone who does, and I see them on the list, domestic relations would perhaps give us a concrete example of when a client comes in, what that lawyer would say if the lawyer wanted to limit the representation and deal with that in a concrete fact situation. Would that be the point of your question, Justice Prosser?
I think the point of my question is this. As a former legislator, normally I'm used to starting with definitions. Here is limited scope representation. This is the definition. When someone comes in within that definition, then such and such steps need to be taken. If you take those steps, you're in great shape. If you don't take those steps, something bad might happen. Okay, so I think this is so hard to get my hands around that I feel a little uncomfortable.
Well, I think we're not trying to change what an attorney-client relationship is, because I don't think we have a solid rule anywhere that describes what is an attorney-client relationship, because it's like trying to describe the stars. There's any number of attorney-client relationships that can exist. We can draft a will, we can draft a deed, we can go to court, we can do a divorce. There's just numerous attorney-client relationships.
You know, I really think that one of the issues, and I'm directing this more to the commissioner, and to people who file petitions, because there is already a section in 20:1-2, and it starts with the scope of representation and allocation of authority between lawyer and client. That's the beginning. And then what has happened here is you're adding sections, subsections, right?
Yes.
And when the court gets this, which is perfectly okay the way our rules are drafted, but when we get it and we got snippets here and there, it's very hard for the court to see how it fits into SCR 21.2. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I think that's why I don't want to compare our petition with others, but if you'll notice, we're suggesting quite a few comments, because I think those comments help with the cross-reference to the other rules that presently exist, and they're going to cross-reference if you adopt the statutory provisions as well to help explain that. We certainly are not worried. We're worried and we're concerned with the substance of what the rule should be for limited scope representation. Why? Because it's been inferred for the last 10 years by PPAC that access to justice and pro se issues are of our top priority. And this is one of the reasons that we're here today, because it's been addressed as a top priority, and limited scope representation issues affect unrepresented and underrepresented litigants who appear before the court, and for those people who are seeking access to justice and access to lawyers. So we certainly are not adverse to having a rework so that it's clear, or that maybe we don't make it difficult to read an existing rule by plugging in a significant change to an existing rule. Perhaps it should be a standalone rule.
Let me just interrupt you for a minute. As I was reading through all of this, I had some difficulty fully understanding the provisions in regard to notice of termination of representation. And then there were provisions in regard to automatic termination of representation. How do those mesh?
Well, one of the concerns that we believe the bar has with limited scope representation when it deals with litigation is that if they're going to enter into a limited scope representation of a client, that the court may not necessarily let them out of the litigation when the time comes for the limited scope of it to end. I've been hired to do X, Y, and Z. I've done X, Y, and Z. It's done. The court case isn't done, but what I was hired to do now ends. So there was a fear that the courts would not necessarily let people out of cases once they were in it. That's why the notice to the court and to the parties that there is a limited scope representation going on, and that notice goes to everybody, and then a firm notice saying now it is done, so that when it is done, the court doesn't have to at that point approve it. It just simply has come to an end. It's an agreement the parties have reached that the attorney is going to provide this, and the client is in agreement with this, and then that when that representation ends, it just comes to an end. The notice provisions are to simply place the court, the parties, and the other attorneys, if they exist, on notice of when it starts and when it comes to an end, so there's a clear line of demarcation.
What happens if the judge says, sorry, too bad, I really need you in this case, you're going to stay on? How does that ultimately end in a termination, or does it?
Well, we have prepared rules that we believe would negate the judge to decide that decision. That was a decision made by the attorney and the client.
Well, if the judge doesn't comply, what do you do? Get a mandamus to try to make the judge let you off the case? I mean, you just end up in a circle there a little bit.
Yeah, well, and that's one of the reasons. One of our proposals is to implement a very serious educational process at the bar and the bench to remind the judges that in the area of limited scope. That this is if we're going to go down this road and allow limited scope, which we've already done, we are going to have to recognize that the attorneys and the clients have decided upon what they're willing to agree to, what they're willing to pay for, and when it's going to come to an end, and that the judge really should not have the authority to intervene in that attorney-client relationship at that point, as long as it's clear and it's in writing. That's why we require the writing part of the informed consent.
Have you surveyed the individual trial judges throughout the state, not the Trial Judges Association, but the men and women who sit on the bench, to determine if they are willing to comply with this kind of a circumstance when they're in the middle of, say, a domestic violence situation, which is always a hot case?
Well, we did survey all of the circuit court judges and the court commissioners, and the overwhelming majority of them felt that the notice to enter into a limited scope representation is important, and the notice of withdrawal is certainly important.
But they didn't want to give up their power to
Well,
tell
I don't,
the jury.
I don't know. I'm drawing my friends. I'm assuming you may be able to answer. I don't remember if we asked that question. You know, are you willing to let them out? I can say this. Most judges will tell you that they are seeing, or at least it's being inferred to them, that there is a limited scope representation going on. Sometimes it's not apparent, but we hear it because we have pro se litigants that said, well, my lawyer told me this.
Well, and that's reflected, isn't it, by the business law section negotiation. I want to commend you and the rest of the committee for working so closely with so many diverse interests. And you've come up with a resolution to their concern, which is reflected, I think, in their memorandum of March 14. I assume that's an accurate representation.
Absolute accurate representation.
I also understand that the committee has been working closely with the Legislative Reference Bureau, and there are a number of proposals that they have made and the committee has made known to the court, which ones of those that they are fine with.
That is correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
Correct.
Yes. So, perhaps one of the speakers that will come up will address the issue of the survey. I don't know if that question was in the survey or not. I just don't remember, to be quite frank.
Thank you.
I think it is important because, you know, we are recognizing that the profession and the practice is changing. It's changing for a lot of reasons. We have an awful lot of pro se litigants. We have an awful lot of underrepresented people. And the profession needs to change with that reality. And the bench has to change with that reality, too, because if we really want to encourage attorneys to provide a valuable resource to this segment of the population that needs it, that we're going to have to recognize that in doing so, we're going to have to work with them. And if they're going to enter into these good written agreements with informed consent, we need to honor that as a judge and say, we recognize that's what you were hired to do. If there's nothing that seems, you know, out of order, or if the client is saying that that's not the agreement, I suppose that's a whole different issue then. But as long as there's nothing on its face or no one is saying there's some type of problem going on, I think judges need to recognize that we have to let them leave when they've agreed to leave.
One of the proposals is to offer comment to currently existing SCR 20.1.16, as I understand it. That Supreme Court rule, 20.1.16, deals with declining or terminating representation. Sub A of that current rule provides, except as stated in paragraph C, a lawyer shall not represent a client or, where representation has commenced, shall withdraw from the representation of a client if, and then it goes on to have what are the standard reasons. In the heat of battle, as we often see in the circuit courts around the state, there may be a situation that arises from time to time when an attorney wants to withdraw under Supreme Court Rule 20.116, and the judge doesn't let that person withdraw. Oftentimes, so as not to disrupt the ability to finish the proceeding, or for a variety of reasons. Again, this, when I say often, this doesn't happen often, but when it does, the reason oftentimes is to maintain the administrative the integrity of the proceedings. How does the rule as proposed and the comment as proposed interact with this 20.1.16 of terminating representation?
Well, it recognizes that there is this new limited scope representation. Getting back to your example, however, assuming there is a limited scope agreement and a representation going on, and then somewhere in the middle or somewhere within the scope of that representation, an attorney finds out that he or she has a problem and needs to withdraw, the same rule would apply because they're within this scope of representation. And they haven't finished it yet, even though it's limited. But if something were to come up at some point within that scope of that limited representation and they have to withdraw or do something, that rule would apply to it just like it would apply to how we do it now.
No, I have a very strong predisposition of belief that the circuit court judge has a lot of power in his or her courtroom and should have a lot of power in his or her courtroom. Does the proposed rule limit the authority of the court to, in isolated circumstances, require continued representation to finish the proceeding?
I don't think it would limit it if there was some type of extraordinary circumstance going on or conditions would change at some point, that there would be some manifest injustice that would go on. But assuming that something hasn't gone completely haywire within the context of litigation, and assuming the case progresses and the limited scope representation progresses from beginning to middle to end without any apparent problems, in other words, a client not contacting the judge saying he didn't comply with our agreement or something else happened, it does change that concept somewhat, because it would allow, without a hearing, without any approval, it would allow that withdrawal based upon the underlying agreement, assuming, again, that something hasn't gone terribly awry in the meantime. So, we did not address the terribly awry exception to it. But I can't imagine a situation in which if an extraordinary circumstance occurred within the time frame of the limited scope representation, that manifest injustice would occur if we just allowed the termination. I suppose it's always within the broad powers of the court to say time out, or at least have a hearing on it.
Or say time in.
Or time in. Yeah. But again, we did not address that catastrophic issue.
I'll tell you how I read it. I read it that putting your notice, this is in court, putting your notice of limited scope representation, when you're done with representing the client, then you will have a notice of termination that you'll file. and that will be the end of your representation. That if the court is not satisfied with that, then the court will operate under 20:1.16, and that there is no amendment here to 20:1.16. For example, in Maine, as I understand it, and this is from the memorandum in support, Maine has a provision that says subsection C, which is 20:1.6, I assume, does not apply to the automatic withdrawal of a lawyer upon completion of a limited scope representation made pursuant to Rule 1.2. So the judge still retains all of his or her current discretion. You just hope that it won't be used at all, or at least not frequently. Is that a correct statement?
Yeah, I mean, we certainly are suggesting that in the normal course of business, that judges not interfere with this withdrawal. And that's one of the reasons that we really want to have an education component to this in that regard. That certainly is our preference, because, to be quite frank, we believe that one of the obstacles to limited scope representation in Wisconsin right now is that there is a degree of uncomfortableness by the bar to enter into these agreements, because there is no safe harbor for them. And I certainly appreciate the court's concerns that there may be areas that could lead to consternation. We think we've created rules that provide safe harbors for attorneys and safe harbors for clients, so that everyone knows what the rules are, and they're all playing on a reasonably level playing field. That was what we were trying to do.
Well, I could see the, as you say, consternation arising within this context in a situation where there is a disagreement between the lawyer and the court as to whether the terms of the limited scope agreement have been fulfilled. And then is that the likely scenario that we're talking about?
Well, I suspect there's bound to be a situation where a client will disagree that the lawyer did what they said they were going to do. Maybe I misunderstood.
No, you're right. I deliberately left out client. We're going to hear, look, if we adopt this rule, we're going to be hearing from everyone. And we'll have to base any consideration of any amendments on how things go. But right now, I could see a judge looking at the representation and saying, hey, it's not done. And someone, whether it's the client or the attorney, saying, and the client complaining to the judge, perhaps would spark the judge's interest in looking at the file, and then the judge agreeing with the client. So what would happen then? A status conference or an order to show cause hearing or something?
Well, the one thing we want to avoid is the judge entering into it and micromanaging it when the judge has been given no indication that there's a problem. So we don't want to have a situation where judges might, just because they feel something might be wrong, to intervene and say, I'm not letting you get out.
Right, and I don't think most judges are looking for problems, so
no,
I assume that's true.
I'm assuming that's true, but we wanted to make it clear, because I think the bar is concerned that there isn't that safe harbor to leave. If something goes wrong, I mean, if a court becomes aware that there is a problem going on, that they didn't do this and they haven't finished the representation, at that point, they'll have to deal with it. At that point, my guess is what will have to happen is at least you have to have a hearing on it.
What would that hearing be called?
Well, it depends on how it's brought before the court. I would imagine, if nothing else, a status conference or something to that effect.
Okay.
But, again, you know, in the event a judge has been notified that there has something has gone wrong with the limited scope agreement, absent that, we feel it's appropriate for the rule to simply allow the attorney to withdraw as long as there's no apparent reason that to indicate that they have not complied with it.
I ask these questions not to point out any perceived infirmities with the proposal. I point them out to help provide clarity to the various courts who are going to be most directly impacted by these, if it's adopted by this procedure. And it's going to be impossible for any of us in this room to anticipate every variety and stripe of parade of horribles that can occur as a result of this, and we'll just, if it's adopted, have to deal with it as they come up, depending on their prevalence and if they're coming up all over the state.
I do think that the apparent unanimous approval by the major stakeholders in the rule suggests that the people that are most concerned with it have looked at it and feel that it's appropriate.
I haven't had experience of an issue in a civil case, but we get them quite frequently in a criminal case where the defendant and the lawyer don't agree, or the defendant wants the lawyer to do something, lawyer says no, and there's a dispute. And the judge says, well, if you can't agree, you can have to get rid of the lawyer, and if you can't do a good job, you either represent yourself or we're going to have to get another lawyer, but does not attempt to accept at the skill level to mediate between them. It explains what the relationship is. And it seems to me, civilly, if they don't agree, you're going to have the same issue. Is the lawyer going to stay or not stay? And if it's an issue of ethics, the trial judge doesn't decide it. It goes to the appropriate discipline proceedings. I mean, that's how I read this.
And I would agree with that. I would agree with that.
All right, are there any other questions?
Do you foresee OLR enforcement of these rules?
Well, as you can see from the list, we had Mr. Sabine on the committee, and he worked with us regarding the rule creation. I would imagine that they would enforce the rule just as they would enforce any other rule. He certainly, it was my impression he was in support of this. He certainly hasn't voiced any objection to it. He did work closely with us. I think it's also important, and I would like to point out one more thing before I forget, but I think to answer your question is I don't see any reason why the Office of Lawyer Regulation would not enforce the rule. And if a
failure to put agreements in writing is a rule violation that could be prosecuted by the Office of Lawyer Regulation.
If you are going to have a limited scope representation, the informed consent needs to be in writing. Just as we have a rule now that says if the legal fee is going to exceed a certain dollar amount, that there has to be something in writing to that effect. So it's the same type of concept.
Is this involve the pro bono representation?
We specifically exempt in our first petition four areas that we do not require a written informed consent. Now there is five. And that was, as Justice Galen brought up, the business law section. We reached a very, very good compromise on that, exempting existing clients or existing attorney-client relationships as not being applicable. Telephone calls and telephone consultations are not applicable. Legal aid, pro bono centers, nonprofit centers providing, it does not apply to them. as well. So we exempted those five areas out specifically from this, as well as the public defender's office, who oftentimes provide representation to an individual at a bail hearing, but they may not eventually be eligible down the road, but sometimes they provide complementary representation at a bail hearing. So they are also exempted.
Does that apply, according as Justice Prosser requested, to attorneys that just voluntarily take on pro bono matters?
Not if they don't fit within the exception. Our proposal doesn't cover a private attorney who's decided to do something pro bono, because a pro bono representation could also be a limited scope. Whether you do it for pay or you do it for free, if you enter into an agreement with a client that says, I'm going to provide this service for you, if this is what you want, it can be limited scope and it can be free.
Right, but from what you're saying, it sounds like with pro bono work, there should be a writing about it, whether it's pro bono or for fee.
Except for the one exception that we talk about for nonprofit organizations that provide legal aid and whatnot, they're going to be exempted from it. They're almost all doing it anyway, but they're exempted from it. But a pro bono lawyer, right. When I was in private practice, when I did pro bono work.
Most firms do. I mean, they do it as part of their community service.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So they're not in an exception.
No, if it's going to be a limited scope in a particular case, then the parameters of that limited scope need to be in writing and consented to.
A lawyer's obligations to the client are the same whether they're paid, the lawyer is paid or not paid.
Exactly. And that's why we feel it shouldn't be treated any differently.
So this applies to lawyer legislators. Who are helping constituents. You must have thought about this.
Justice Prosser, to be quite honest with you, I don't think that issue ever came up in any of our discussions about a licensed practitioner who is in the legislature helping a constituent. I don't think, I'll let my colleagues refresh memory, I don't think we ever discussed that
legislator practices law. In the old days, Fred Risser, I don't know if he still does, practiced law in Madison. Should he be held to when he represented a client, should he be held to a different standard?
If they are providing a legal service to a client, for pay or not, the rules apply to them as it would apply to anybody else, it seems to me.
I think Justice Prosser's question, though, was more about a lawyer who is a legislator and is trying to get some legislation passed in that capacity representing a client.
That's not what I'm talking about.
Okay. And I'm not understanding.
I helped countless numbers of people as a legislator on various matters, giving advice, sometimes helping with forms.
Right.
And you're saying that under your rule, I would have been subject to prosecution by the Office of Lawyer Regulations. That's the way I read it.
Well, I'm not saying that. I'm saying if you enter into an attorney-client relationship, whether it's limited scope or not, the rules apply. If you do not enter into an attorney-client relationship, then I don't think the rules apply.
But what is an attorney-client relationship? That's like the stars in the sky, and you didn't define that, and you said it didn't necessarily involve money.
Well, PPAC, we were not asked to define the parameters of an attorney-client relationship. That was not one of the things we were asked to do. What we were asked to do is within the confines of an attorney-client relationship, there can be a limited scope of that representation.
So if you practice law as a legislator, you came under these rules, period. Now if you practice law as a legislator and you want to do limited practice, You can do limited practice if you follow these rules. The problem is, where does helping a constituent as a legislator not practice of law flip over to when is it the practice of law? So if the legislator says to a constituent, this looks like a DNR problem to me, and the head of the fishing division, who specializes in walleyes, is Joe Smith, you ought to go see him. I don't think that's practicing law. But once you start giving advice as to what else to do, you may or may not have a problem. But that's not indigenous to this, inherent in this issue.
I don't believe so, and I don't believe that we are changing anything in that regard, because if in fact that issue exists, and I presume it does now, that means it's always existed. And we're not suggesting, or I don't think our rules would change. If you enter into an attorney-client relationship, you enter into an attorney-client relationship, whatever that may be. But I don't think that providing a limited basis of it would necessarily change whether or not an attorney who is also a legislator would have to comply with the rules of ethics regarding competence and diligence and all the other rules that apply regarding that.
I want to go back.
It's a great question, by the way.
I want to go back to one of Justice Process' other questions about definitions, and they're in 20:1.0 AG and others. And the only one I found that's applicable here, but I may have missed, is informed consent. Informed consent denotes the agreement by a person to a proposed course of conduct after the lawyer has communicated adequate information and explanation about the material risks and reasonably available alternatives to the proposed course of conduct. And as I understand it, that definition applies.
Yes. We are just saying that if it's going to be a limited basis, that informed consent needs to be in writing. And the consent needs to be in writing by the client that they understand that, and it's been explained to them.
Are there any other questions?
I really don't want to take away time from my colleagues. So.
Well, I was going to tell you, Judge Anderson, that after we've heard everyone who's signed up and those who want to speak who haven't signed up, you will have an opportunity to come back and draw it all to a great climax.
I will try not to put too much pressure on myself.
You can do it.
With that, if there aren't any other questions, I will step back and
but
let the
you
others.
You do have time for rebuttal, and so I will call you.
Very good.
On that.
Thank you very much.
Thank
Justice.
You, Judge Anderson. And I want to express on behalf of the court the court's thanks to the PPAC Limited Scope Representation a subcommittee and to the staff. I know the efforts at drafting and redrafting and getting comments from people who are affected by it and improving the draft as you went along, and that's very important. So thank you to everybody, and thank you for the list. I have on my list of speakers Tim Pierce, Judge Michael Dwyer, Attorney Diane Deal, Greg Moore, James Gramling, and Carlo Esqueda. Does anyone else wish to appear? Okay, if you change your mind, please give your name to the marshal, and we'll call on you. Mr. Pierce, and it's desirable that you not repeat what others have said and just say you concur and join them, but we want you all to have an opportunity to educate the court on this petition.
Good morning, and thanks. I will strive to be brief. I am Tim Pierce. I'm ethics counsel for the State Bar. Previous to that, I worked at the Office of Lawyer Regulation for about 8 years. So I'm the unusual lawyer in Wisconsin who's done nothing but practice professional responsibility law for well over a decade. And I wanted to give the court my experience both working in the disciplinary agency and as the quote-unquote hotline guy at the State Bar who lawyers call when they choose to for advice. I've been doing the advising aspect of my job for about 9 years, and I can say I frequently get questions about limited scope representation. It's been a consistent theme such that after I had been at the job for a few years, I developed an outline and a CLE presentation specifically to help with lawyers from the Legal Aid Society, lawyers who simply wanted to engage in it privately. So at least from my experience with a self-selected group of Wisconsin lawyers, this is a topic of interest. And what I believe the petition in front of the court today does is it accomplishes the important goal of providing safe harbor and guidance to a few key areas that recur constantly when lawyers call me and ask for advice how to conduct limited scope representation. First, the biggest sticking point, or one of the most frequent questions, is the lack under current Wisconsin law of a provision for a limited appearance. We have Supreme Court Rule 11.02, which simply provides for a general appearance, and the provisions in the statutes specifically allow for a limited appearance. And in my experience in speaking to lawyers and giving CLE presentations, that is a source of consternation and a deterrent to providing limited scope representation because the lawyer can't look and see, and I can't tell them when they ask me, is there some way or something that I can point to that will allow me or at least provide guidance if I simply am hired to do the custody hearing as opposed to other aspects of a matter.
I have a little problem when you use the word limited appearance. As a lawyer trained many years ago, he either made a general appearance, which gave the court jurisdiction over your person, the person of your client, or you made a limited appearance.
Or a special appearance.
Mm-hmm. Where you said, I am appearing for Ann Walsh Bradley, but it is a limited appearance and we are not submitting to the jurisdiction of this personal jurisdiction of this court. And I am here to tell you why this court has no jurisdiction over Justice Bradley because, you know, she was not properly served. And if I don't do that, then I'm waiving. I might be waiving any defects or forfeiting any defects. So when you say limited appearance, you mean limited scope appearance. You're not talking general versus special.
That's absolutely
correct. Okay, that's
correct.
Good.
Forgive me for misspeaking.
I'm sorry to have interrupted you, but I never thought that a lawyer ever had a trouble making a limited appearance, limited or special appearance.
A limited scope appearance.
Okay, good. All right.
And I think what this petition does is it gives lawyers something they can see in the statute, meaning here is the procedure that I can use. So it fills a hole that currently exists. When I get the question, is there any way, is there anything I can point to that says...
Well, why couldn't they point to 1.2C? A lawyer may limit the scope of the representation if it's reasonable under the circumstance and you got informed consent. I always thought that was good enough.
It is good enough for the lawyer and the client agreeing to do that, but that rule of professional conduct is not binding on the court per se.
Right.
In that it doesn't provide that procedure for
the notice of limited appearance and the termination of limited
worried appearance. Worried about the
court. That's right. And that has been a constant expression of concern to me. So I believe it accomplishes that goal. And if I could just touch on a point that was brought up before, I do believe that under the rules that exist and would not be changed by this petition, in that unusual circumstance where a court wished a lawyer to continue, the lawyer would be bound by 1.16C, which requires the lawyer to continue the representation when ordered to do so notwithstanding good cause for withdrawal.
And that's still in the...
That is not altered in any way, shape, or form.
But you're going to want us to educate the judges not to do that.
I believe the intention of the committee was that this provision would provide a procedure that would allow the lawyer providing limited representation not to have to file the normal withdrawal motion, have a hearing on withdrawal.
You know, that's one of the things that just bothered me. One time I read it, I thought they don't give notice of withdrawal. And next time I read it, I thought they did. So what is it? Do you have to file a notice that you're not going to be there anymore?
Mm-hmm. I believe the intent is that the notice of termination of limited representation serves what would otherwise be a motion for withdrawal.
So it's a notice, and it doesn't say, dear court, let us out. It says, I'm going. And if the judge doesn't want you to go, it's up to the judge to say, no, you're not.
I think the point of the notice is for the lawyer to tell the court, I've fulfilled my agreement with my client, and I've done what I've told the court do when I entered the limited appearance pursuant to this statute, that I have done what I've promised to do, and I'm notifying the court and the parties that I've completed those limited scope services to the clients.
This court has struggled. Well, let me be personal. I have struggled for years trying to know exactly what the practice of law is or the unauthorized practice of law is, and sometimes that's a difficult inquiry. But the one I want to focus on now is when is the attorney-client relationship established? We see all the time people coming in for an initial free consultation. And whether people come in and want to talk about their problems, and the attorney may give some advice, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the attorney-client relationship has been established in that initial free consultation. In fact, of course, we have a rule about the required fee agreement in writing under certain conditions. What do you tell those people who call you that would ask about what's the indicia of the establishment of the attorney-client relationship in that or other contexts?
Well, I believe there's two aspects to that. First, a lawyer's responsibilities towards a prospective client, which is someone who discusses with the lawyer the possibility of forming a lawyer-client relationship, is governed by a specific rule of professional conduct right now, Rule 1.18. So that provides guidance for that initial consultation where both the lawyer and the prospective client determine whether or not they want to formalize the lawyer-client relationship.
So in the context, before the relationship is formalized, there still can be the giving and receiving of legal advice, I assume.
There can be. And the existence of an actual lawyer-client relationship is intentionally left out of the rules of professional conduct and is a creature of common law. Most frequently when a lawyer asks me for guidance, I refer them to Section 14 of the Restatement of the Law Governing Lawyers, which sets forth a test. Essentially, a person looks to a lawyer based on their knowledge that they are a lawyer. Number two, they actively seek legal representation from the lawyer. And number three, the lawyer either agrees or fails to manifest lack of consent under circumstances in which the person can reasonably rely.
And that's the lawyer displays or reasonably displays active consent. Consent to be retained as free or on a payment basis, consent to be retained in a lawyer-client relationship.
That is correct.
Okay. It's an agreement.
It's an agreement.
Either by words or conduct.
That is correct. And as in many, for people in my position who advise other lawyers, the restatement is an excellent resource. And it also provides guidance on the lawyer's rendition of advice in the prospective client relationship. In the context of this petition, if I were asked, a lawyer who's meeting with a prospective client and chooses to render some advice while saying, I choose not to take your case and form that contractual relationship with you, would not fall under the limited scope representation.
It is only until that contractual relationship is established that you have the attorney-client obligation.
My understanding, both at the time I was at the Office of Lawyer Regulation and I can speak to in the late 90s and early 2000s when I worked there, it happens. We saw limited scope representation all the time. It was not a question to us as to whether or not it was permissible. At that time, it was called limiting the objectives as opposed to scope of representation. But we still knew what it meant. It happens all the time now, and there's not a question of that. However, what I think the intent of sub C as it exists now and sub C as we propose to amend it would apply to that stage of agreement. I agree to provide you representation, but limited in the sense that, for example, in a family law matter, I may not go to court with you, but I will provide you explicit legal advice and perhaps drafting assistance, but I will not appear in court for you. That is to say, the agreement between the lawyer and the prospective client. The second area that I just wanted to touch upon briefly to the court because of the frequency of questions I get about it is ghostwriting. And ghostwriting is when a lawyer agrees to provide legal drafting services in connection with pleadings or other documents that would be filed with the court, but the lawyer does not agree to go and appear in front of the court. As it stands under Wisconsin law right now, there's nothing that explicitly says it is acceptable, nor is there anything that explicitly says it is unacceptable. So, again, this is an area where providing guidance will provide a safe harbor to lawyers that will encourage them to say, at least if I choose to do this, I have a safe harbor to provide this type of limited scope legal services.
I was just going to have you remind me. I recollect that now a lawyer for certain written documents has to have a statement saying it was lawyer assistance, but you don't have to name the lawyer.
Yeah, in essence, what our petition does is take a middle road. There's three positions you could take in connection with ghostwriting. No disclosure of lawyer involvement, disclosure that a lawyer was involved in the drafting, but not the name of the specific lawyer. And the third position would be the name of the specific lawyer. And at least from my perspective as sort of a risk management advisor to lawyers, having no explicit position within the state is difficult for lawyers because there are federal cases from various other jurisdictions that require explicit disclosure. In certain federal circuits, If I choose to ghostwrite, there's case law that says I have to put my name on those documents. So the fact that those cases exist can make lawyers nervous when I tell them. On the other hand, there is authority, at least there's a good ABA ethics opinion that provides guidance to say, at least under the currently constructed model rules, you need not disclose. So you have consternation via the case law, opinions on other ends, and I believe at least the middle road taken, number one, provides that safe harbor for lawyers, and at least can address some of the concerns, which I'll let the judges address, that may come from the bench.
I'm sorry, I missed something. What are you recommending?
Our recommendation is that when a lawyer agrees to provide limited scope representation that simply consists of drafting documents or pleadings that the otherwise pro se client will file with the court, that the lawyer draft the documents, including a statement that says, this document was prepared with the assistance of counsel, and inform the client that the document must have that statement, this document was prepared with the assistance of counsel.
How does that square with when you draft a deed, you have to say your name and that you're and put it at the bottom of the deed. So if there's a problem, then Register of Deeds needs to go back and check on you. If you're doing that, does that fit within this ghostwriting provision at all?
The intention behind the ghostwriting document would, or provisions applies to pleadings, documents.
Only court matters.
That is
Thank
correct.
You. Thank you.
That.
Now, and does it apply beyond limited representation? In other words, the client has lawyers galore here. Three or four firms, they're all on the briefs, but it was written by somebody else. What do we, is that covered by this?
No, in my opinion, I don't believe that the proposed amendments to 1.2 would require the inclusion of names of associates when the partner's name is signed and bar number is on the brief. It's intended to address the situation. This is, again, because of case law from other jurisdiction where courts have been concerned that I have a pro se, seemingly pro se document that I, the judge, believe there's a problem with. I strongly believe there was a lawyer involved with it. I want to know. And it would not require the name of every lawyer who provided some research or drafting on that.
Even so, if outside of the firm. I mean, I think that there are some firms of varying sizes who contract out their brief writing, appellate writing, but you wouldn't know that when it appears before our court because it's the name of the firm that's representing the client rather than the contract out appellate work.
Yeah. Yes, that's true. But I believe under that circumstance, because the lawyer who signs the pleading, him or herself, assumes all the responsibilities that go with filing that document in front of the court. So the questions or the concerns that arise in ghostwriting situations where there's no indication of the involvement of a lawyer often have to do with a court's concern that there might be false statements of fact in a pleading or other improper behavior. So the court that way will, if I'm the lawyer who hires somebody else to draft my brief and then I sign my name to it, I'm telling the court I assume responsibility for this document. The final area that comes up frequently with respect to me is the issue of 4.2 and communication with represented parties. I've frequently had a situation wherein a lawyer would call me and seem to be litigating against a pro se person and may have a conversation in a hall before or after a hearing, and the person would say, well, let me run this past my lawyer after the conversation has commenced. I have received several very worried calls that, gee, have I just committed an ethical violation by speaking with that person? They did not tell me they were consulting with a lawyer behind the scenes, and now they did. I believe the proposed amendments to 4.2 and 4.3, which allow the lawyer to treat the person receiving limited scope representation as unrepresented unless and until the lawyer who is providing the limited scope legal services puts them on notice, again, provides another safe harbor that, at least in my experience, I see lawyers expressing concern about.
What I found somewhat interesting was, although the client has a limited scope lawyer, the client is referred to in the rule as unrepresented.
I believe the intent is to allow opposing counsel to treat that lawyer for purpose, that client rather, for purposes of communicating about the matter, that which would otherwise be prohibited by Rule 4.2, as unrepresented for purposes of that rule.
Well, it's going to happen in other areas. We have a rule pending that I think we heard in the last few weeks about information. This was a judicial code provision, allowing the judge to give information to an unrepresented client, not represent the client, not give them legal advice, but to explain what might happen at the trial or in the proceeding and what might be required of him. Are you familiar with what I'm talking about?
In a general sense.
And I did not go back and look at that proposal to see if it used the same terminology that this used.
I am not familiar enough with that petition for the Code of Judicial Conduct. I can say conceptually in advising lawyers, if I agree to provide limited scope representation to a client, I do believe that that client is properly considered unrepresented for matters outside the scope of representation. It's
so
generally
in scope,
accepted.
In scope represented, out scope not represented.
Yes. Okay. And that would apply to any sort of legal representation. I represent clients for specific matters.
And a lawyer for the other side can speak to the client about unrepresented matters, but not about represented matters. Is that right?
That is correct. And with the purpose of our, for example, if I were providing ghostwriting limited scope assistance to a client, unless I notified the opposing counsel that I wanted communications to come through me, and in essence expand the scope of my representation, that opposing counsel would not be violating any rule clearly by speaking to the otherwise pro se person at a hearing, outside of a hearing, etc. The last point I wanted to quickly address was your concern, Justice Prosser, about a legislature providing assistance to constituents. I do not believe that any current or proposed provision of Rule 1.2 would apply to a legislature who is both a lawyer and a legislator in providing the normal course of constituent assistance. Because, as I attempted to allude to earlier, Rule 1.2 is intended to apply to the confines of a lawyer-client relationship, which I do not believe arises in the normal interaction between a legislator their office staff in dealing with the concerns of their constituent.
Well, suppose a constituent comes to you and says, these statutes dealing with name changes are just terrible, and I've got a 16, this is an actual matter, but it didn't involve ethics, a 16-year-old who wants to take the name of the mother's husband, but can't, used to not be able to do it unless the father, the biological father, agreed. But the biological father couldn't be found, and et cetera. And a legislator was sitting on the a ride-along program, heard this, and went back and drafted a law that said, hey, if it's 16 and you do this, this, that, and publish notice that, I don't remember what the rules are, then the child can take the name that he wanted. So if you drafted that rule, that law for the constituent, would that be practicing law?
No, I don't believe so.
Why not?
I don't believe so because if you look again at sort of the common law test of the formation of a lawyer-client relationship, I believe that the person approaching the legislator in their capacity as a legislator through their offices as a legislator has a reasonable belief that they are getting legal services in the confines of a lawyer-client relationship. Nor do I believe that the legislator is reasonably believing that I am forming a lawyer-client relationship with this person. Suggesting changes in legislation, attempting to intermediate between a constituent and a government agency are all normal functions of legislature, and that happening through the legislator's office, I don't believe would reasonably fit the normal test of forming a lawyer-client relationship.
What about the legislative aide who drafts the bill?
Again, I would view that as a normal function of a legislative office and not the practice of law within the confines of a lawyer-client relationship. You know, I would sort of point out to the court, too, that when the court adopted Chapter 23 of the Supreme Court rules, the definition in Wisconsin of the practice of law, there are a long list of exceptions which are not considered the unauthorized practice of law, whether or not they are the practice of law. So there are many things of a legal nature that non-lawyers can do that do not automatically mean I am having a client, lawyer-client relationship and practicing law within that context.
Or, interpreted a different way, they are the practice of law, but they are being authorized.
They are engaged in the authorized
practice of law.
Practice of law.
If it's not unauthorized.
But I thank you for your time. I do believe, as somebody who advises lawyers, that this will be of great assistance, remove a fair amount of uncertainty, and help lawyers to provide more services to people of limited means. So I hope the court strongly considers adopting it. Thank you for your time.
Counsel?
Mr. Pierce?
Sorry. Justice Prosser?
I'm just as a way of clarifying these issues in my mind. You yourself give advice to people who call you. Does this rule affect you in any way?
That's an interesting question. Traditionally, people who fulfill my function with bar associations and provide lawyer-to-lawyer consultation, it has not been viewed as forming a lawyer-client relationship. There is an ABA ethics opinion, which is useful guidance for folks in my line of work, that at least stands for the proposition that usually the consulting lawyer and the lawyer, me, on the other end, who's providing guidance on how to conform one's conduct to the rules of professional conduct, neither party under that circumstances has a reasonable belief that they are actually forming a lawyer-client relationship. But most people in my position who do my job, we don't speak in generalities. We try to provide as specific guidance as we can to assist the lawyer in that circumstance.
Well,
but I would not, if I were calling myself and asking my own advice, if this rule would come to be adopted, I would tell myself, I don't think I have to comply with the requirements of 1.2 sub C when I speak to somebody on the hotline.
Why not? Because you're not their lawyer?
That's correct. I believe I'm not their lawyer at that point.
Well, can you, not of course that you would, but are you free to repeat the conversations you've had with a lawyer? Is there a privilege?
No, I don't believe I am, because there is a specific state bar rule requiring that I keep consultations or communications, not just with me, but with the State Bar Standing Committee on Professional Ethics, confidential.
Now, do people ever come to you in person rather than call you up on the telephone?
Yes, they do.
They do. So that exception is not going to, first exception on the telephone consultation wouldn't apply in those cases.
No, it would not.
Interesting.
But you don't view yourself as practicing law.
Well, you're making me very uncomfortable.
Okay. I should have said you don't view yourself as having a lawyer-client relationship.
Yeah.
I've been looking at W2302W, and I'm not sure you come under this either. Teaching about the law, maybe, but that may be much more.
When I give a CLE.
Right. And this is the interesting one, I think, or providing information about the law, including the legal rights or responsibilities of persons under the law. So far, so good. Now we have a little trouble. In a manner that is not directed at providing specific legal advice to a specific individual in the context of a specific matter.
Well, I would say the following. For people in my line of work, it's a gray area. Because
by the time you finish, you'll be disbarred. Mr. Pierce, I'm working on it.
You have a right to remain silent. You have a right to...
Luckily, my friend Keith Saline is not here today. One can make a reasonable argument that, in essence, what I or other people do through these types of bar-provided services is I'm providing limited-scope legal advice under Rule 6.5, which is a provision in both the ABA model rules and Wisconsin's rules, which essentially frees me of all complex responsibility.
I want one of those.
I'm just getting that in there.
Who under the auspices of a program sponsored by a nonprofit or bar association provides short-term limited legal services to a client without expectation by either the lawyer or client that you're going to do continuing risk representation. Got it.
One could view that, although both I and my compatriots who work in other states continue to adhere to the view that we are not actually forming even a limited scope lawyer-client relationship. And again, we rely on guidance provided by state bar opinions and the ABA opinion that I referenced.
Mr. Pierce, because we have you here, we're asking questions about a whole series of things that have come up over a whole series of months and years that have nothing to do with you or limited scope representation. It's just we don't see you often enough to get all of this free legal advice.
Free consultation.
Legal advice, consultation. I lost my head for the moment. Yes. Okay.
All right. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Oh, here's my list. attorney Diane Deal, former president of the State Bar. Oh, I'm sorry. Judge Dwyer, I did not intend to take you out of turn. That's why you look so surprised, Ms. Deal.
Chief Justice Abrahamson, honorable justices, may it please the court. The last time I was in this room was 1975 when I was sworn in as a lawyer. And I want you to know how honored I am to appear before this esteemed court on this particular rule petition. I was a member of both of the working groups that presented it. What I would like to focus on is why this rule is needed, why it's so important. The reason for the rule is to encourage lawyers to provide limited scope representation, to increase the availability of legal services to clients. And I want to talk about that in the context of the family court. By way of background, I was a small firm practice lawyer, solo for 11 years, but total for 22 years. My practice included family law. I am in my 17th year on the trial bench, and somewhat unusually in a mandatory rotation system, seven of those years I have spent on the family bench in Milwaukee. In Milwaukee, five judges and 10 court commissioners grant about 3,000 divorces a year, adjudicate in excess of 6,000 paternity cases a year, and handle uncounted post-judgment matters, which actually are sometimes the hardest cases we handle. And what I have seen is that the traditional delivery of legal services system has failed in the family court context. Now, the phenomenon of the self-represented litigant is, of course, well known to everyone. And I don't have, and I frankly don't think there are, real firm statistics about exactly what the state of self-represented litigation is in family court. But I think it's generally accepted that overall in family court, 70 or 80% of the litigants appear without counsel. Now, that includes paternity cases where there are virtually no lawyers. I think I have heard it said, and I have repeated many times, that about 20% of the divorce cases have lawyers on both sides. In about 40% of the cases, there's one lawyer. The bottom line is that lawyers are vanishing from the family court system. I say that because this trend, which started how many years ago, 25 or 30 years ago, has only increased over time. I'm certain that you will all agree that the issues in a family case are of the utmost importance to a person. We are talking about the custody and placement of their children, ownership of their homes, their financial futures. And so we have to ask ourselves, why do they not come with lawyers? Well, I believe that the main reason, although not the only reason, but the main reason is cost. And the reason family court litigation is expensive is because it's time-consuming, especially custody litigation, very time-consuming and labor-intensive. And the model of service delivery is hourly rate representation. I submit to you that the problem is not the hourly rate, which is problematic for, you know, a person who makes $10 an hour, a $300 an hour lawyer is problematic, but I don't think that's ultimately the problem in family court. The problem is the delivery system. And what is the delivery system? It's full service representation. A lawyer, a client, goes to a lawyer, hires that lawyer on an hourly basis, and pays a retainer fee. And for people of modest means, the model simply doesn't work. Take a sort of an average retainer fee in a divorce case, $1,500. Take a person of modest means, say $30,000 a year income. What's the likelihood that that person has $1,500 available to them to retain a lawyer? The simple fact is very few of them do.
Judge, if you could pick one area for limited term representation in a divorce, what area would you encourage the bar to try to get involved in most frequently?
That's a great question. I think what I would ask them to do is to draft marital settlement agreements to retain someone, to put into writing the agreements of the parties that the agreements had reached and the legal documents necessary to grant the divorce. Now,
that covers all the issues in the divorce.
You caught me. It does, in a sense, beg the question. But the difficulty of talking about family court cases is, of course, they run the gamut from the simplest to the most complicated, with children, without children, with assets, without assets. And I guess...
reasonable people and with unreasonable people.
Of course, of course. Another area that I think would be an effective way of utilizing limited legal representation would be settlement conferences.
I'm sorry, the what?
Settlement conferences. To have a lawyer attend with you, with the client, a meeting with the other party, the other party's counsel, if they had counsel, to try to hash out those issues. So my point is that the reason that we don't have lawyers is because people lack access to them. One of the cruel realities of the system that we do have is that people who hire lawyers, under the current system, they pay their retainer, they start the case. By the time the retainer is used up, they're right in the meat of the case where it's most important that they have legal advice, and they run out of money. And this is a huge problem. Now, some other areas, Justice Rogensack, that where a lawyer could be helpful is starting the procedure, starting the proceeding, preparing the petition, giving instructions on filing and service. Some people have a hard time with that. To be honest, most don't under our current circumstances. And frankly, in a full-service situation with a limited budget, it can be kind of a waste of money to get the lawyer to do that part of the job.
The forms are good enough?
Pardon?
Are you saying the forms are good enough?
I will say that the forms are good enough. I know that there are many detractors of the forms. I've done hundreds of divorces. The forms are good enough. They work for people getting their cases before the court. Now, there was, of course, no form. Well, I was going to say there's no form for the marital settlement agreement. There is actually a form, but the only important parts of it are the blank spaces on the form. So, some other areas, requesting or attending a temporary hearing, and that might be another area, especially where there are children, to get a temporary custody and placement order in place, to get child support set. It is often said in family court litigation that the temporary order determines the outcome of the case. Therefore, that would be a useful place to do it. An area of tremendous need for litigants is handling their real estate and their pension. And the legal problems regarding their home and their pension are the same whether or not the home is worth $20,000 or $200,000. Likewise, the pension. And I have had the experience over and over again sitting in a pretrial where we're talking with self-represented parties and the question of the house comes up or the question of the pension comes up. And what you realize is they don't even know they have a question, much less an answer. And in a full-service sort of world where I send these people of very limited means out to retain a lawyer, the retainer agreement is a non-starter. And we could go on. I think that family law is unique in its parcel out ability. If that's a word. There are discrete tasks that are required in a divorce that a person can tap into and get effective help.
It was really the University of Wisconsin had a program, I don't know if it's still running, whereby the law students would tell the clients, I have to be careful, I shouldn't maybe use the word clients, tell the litigants what they had to bring to a hearing. So if they were at a stage of dealing with finances, bring your tax return, your last return or whatever, your W-2, et cetera, maybe your tax bill for the house showing value, and whatever is required. And that could be parceled out and was quite precise. Judges found that helpful because when they came in, theoretically had everything for a decision.
And we are blessed in Milwaukee County to have the Milwaukee Justice Center.
I know, that's why I raised this with you.
And it is an invaluable resource, precisely for the reason that you state that we do not have, our clerks actually, do not have to turn people away repeatedly because they lack a necessary piece of paper. And if we do turn them away, at least we have a place to send them to where they can find out what piece of paper is missing and get some information about what the paper is and how to get it. So what does all this have to do with the rule petition? As we all know, limited scope representation has been permitted for a long time. This is not a new concept. In the business world, this is routine. In-house counsel, in-house corporate counsel, its whole function is to limit the scope of the legal services that the company purchases from lawyers. So it's not a new thing. Where it is uncommon is in cases that are pending in court. And one reason for that, I believe, is we are a very tradition-bound profession. And change comes slow to us. And the full-service model of delivery has worked for us for 500 years? I don't know how they charged in medieval England, but it certainly worked for 100 years. And so the profession sees the problem as something other than the way we deliver legal services. Honestly, I believe that there are lawyers who still believe that if they engaged in limited scope representation, that they would be losing business. My answer to them is, look at the business that you have lost and tell me that there is no way for you to find a way to provide legal value to people who need it on a basis that is not profitable to you. It's just not, I don't think, a valid argument. The problem with it are the gray areas that Tim has so ably addressed. And by the way, if you have a chapter and verse question, I'm not going to answer it. I'm going to defer to Tim Pierce because he knows all those rules. And I think that the biggest concern, and we've already talked about this, is that the lawyer who makes the limited representation is not allowed to that agreement is not honored. The old in for a penny, in for a pound argument. The purpose of the rule is to make it crystal clear that this is a good thing. this limited appearance, that this is not something that is suspicious or something that a judge in receiving a notice of termination should be suspicious that something nefarious is going on, and providing clear rules and procedures. The rule does not answer all the questions. It does. There are gray areas remain, and there will be abuses. There will be circumstances where the limitation is not reasonable, which is in our current rule. Those things will happen. But the purpose of the rule is to encourage this and make it possible. Now, let's be clear about the rule. The rule is not going to cause tremendous change upon its adoption. In fact, what I think it does do is basically enable the legal marketplace to adapt itself to a crucial, critical need in our family courts, in particular, where the where there's a need for development. The marketplace needs to answer Justice Rogensack's question about what's the best area for limited scope representation. And clients need to understand limited scope representation. I mean, let's face it, clients don't know full service representation from limited scope, which is why the informed consent is so important and so difficult. And I believe that by enacting this rule, we will do something to address a problem that has bedeviled us for decades, and that is the absence of lawyers in family cases. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Judge Dwyer, and thank you for your experience in family courts, and that is, of course, one of the large areas where people have, over the last decades, more and more represented themselves in very important matters that affect their lives and their children. And it'll be interesting to see whether the lawyers will increase limited scope representation when they, at least from my perspective, which is I'm not in the courts, where they are self-represented, you don't have as much limited representation, much unbundling of services, the way we used to call it, as might have been expected. But we shall see.
I do believe that what's happening now is there are lawyers. It's happening. Don't get me wrong. But lawyers are doing it sort of cautiously and uncertainly, and they're avoiding making appearances in court for fear of unintended consequences. So I believe that this rule is something that we can do to address that very serious problem.
Well, thank you, Justice Prosser.
First, I want to congratulate you on your statement. I thought it was excellent. All the witnesses this morning have been excellent, but I think you really gave a reason for this rule that is quite easy to understand and very compelling. When Justice Rogensack asked you the question about what particular area of family law would be most suitable for the role of the attorney, you talked about marital settlement agreements. Who would the attorney be representing?
In that case, the attorney would represent one of the clients.
One side?
One side. We do not permit, rightly, joint representation in family cases because of the adverse nature of their relationship. I have another petition in mind related to this question, but we're not going to go there.
That's your mediation?
Yes.
All right. Let's not go there.
Let's not go there.
But you used the phrase tradition-bound profession, and it seemed to me that one of those things is, well, this would really be helpful if someone could draft a marital settlement agreement, but it could only represent one side.
Absolutely.
Is that part of the tradition-bound profession? And as another part, my Lord, we have to put all of this stuff in writing because that's part of our tradition-bound profession.
Put the agreement in writing or the limited scope in writing?
No, all of this limited scope. I mean, oh, we got to protect everything, you know. Boom, boom, boom. Particularly someone who's providing pro bono services. Okay, now we got a form, and if it's Appendix A, we're going to have to check all of these boxes and blah, 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 blah. Holy cow. And if we don't do that, then we might get a visit from the Office of Lawyer Regulation.
Two responses. One is that historically, there are very few ethical complaints filed against either pro bono lawyers or providers of limited scope. So we were told in our deliberations that this is, that certainly it's theoretically possible, but it's not common. It's not common. And the second point is pro bono. One of the tremendous disincentives to a lawyer today taking a pro bono appointment is in for a penny, in for a pound. That they provide full service representation to a person for free. That person, remember the client, the lawyer didn't get to vet this client and agree to take it because the person had a worthy cause and was a reasonable person. This person has a paid warrior on an unlimited basis. Passing this rule, I think, would result fairly soon in limited scope pro bono projects, which lawyers would be much more willing to engage in than they are now because of the full service representation model.
Thank you.
Judge, I have a question. One of the things that I thought was interesting was when you indicated that lawyers right now were not doing this because of unintended consequences. What did you mean by that?
Well, I'm thinking about the fear that by getting engaged in a family court case, they will get drawn in ways that they do not intend. That they have agreed with the client that what they can do on a limited basis is useful to the client. The lawyer's willing to do it. The fee's affordable and understood. But the fear, because it's just not the norm, the fear is that that limitation would not be honored. And this rule makes it clear that it's a good thing. It provides rules and regulations to govern it, and it will take away some of that fear.
Is there fear that the judge won't let them out?
Absolutely. And let me just say this. There are judges who will not let lawyers out, even if we adopt this rule. I mean, that's going to happen. But it doesn't argue against the rule. And there will be, as I say, there are hard cases. That certainly can be posited. But I think that the idea is to elevate this in our traditional full-service profession, that this is legitimate law. And if it's done properly and according to the rules, should be honored.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I've got four speakers and 30 minutes. So each speaker should, and I'm sorry, I really have five, if I'm true to my word of letting Judge Anderson wind this up. So first one will be Attorney Diane Deal. I think this may have started in your administration, or is that some other petition we had recently? Go ahead.
Thank you, Chief Justice and members of the court. It is indeed my pleasure to appear before you today, in part because the value of being a past president of the bar is that you get to be a current practitioner of law. This is a topic that I gave considerable thought to from two perspectives as the president of the State Bar of Wisconsin. It was my privilege to have the opportunity to appoint Attorney Mary Wolverton to the PPAC committee and asked her particularly to become involved in this committee because at that time I had been looking at and beginning to practice in limited scope representation on a substantial basis. I also believed and continue to believe that this is a growth area for the value of delivering legal services to people who could otherwise not attain legal services. I think it is an access to justice issue, and I think it is an issue that puts the full imprimatur of the rules behind a system that is otherwise anecdotal, rife with some insecurity, and unclear to practitioners as to how they might best practice in a limited scope. Justice Prosser asked earlier, how do you form this limited scope representation engagement? Why does that happen? And I want to tell the court that that happens to me almost every time a prospective client contacts my office. Clients are informed these days whether their means are in the upper one-half of 1% of all net worths or whether they are in the bottom one-third of net worths. They're informed by the Internet. They're informed by the availability of pro se representation materials and self-help clinics. And yet, regardless of all of those resources, they often need an attorney to help them marshal the information, put it together, and make it comprehensible. And so I receive those calls frequently, people who are already aware of the possibility of my limited scope services. I do limited scope. As the court may recall, I collaborate. I sign, in many cases, a limited scope representation agreement that says I am involved in a divorce for the purposes of negotiation, settlement, and only make an uncontested appearance in a court in order to enter a default divorce. More so lately, I receive numerous calls from individuals who have participated in mediation processes. In those mediation processes, those litigants are by and large unrepresented, and they're looking for advice as to whether or not they've made an arrangement, an agreement that is workable, fair, balanced, and they're looking for help in trying to make that agreement, sort of to Judge Dwyer's point about what's the biggest value, how do we write that into a marital settlement agreement. It is my personal view that this rule petition is the product of wonderful deliberation and careful consideration and will give clarity to practicing lawyers as to how to go about providing both the informed consent that clients must have in order to enter a limited scope representation agreement, and will help the lawyer understand the ways in which the lawyer can be confident that the scope is reasonable. In family court, the limited scope representation, notice of representation, I think is going to be, by practice, able to develop clearly, more so in the last 3 or 4 years than ever before in my career. Family courts, like Judge Dwyer and others here today, accept partial marital settlement agreements. I prepare on a regular and routine basis a partial marital settlement agreement in my limited scope work as to custody and placement, for example, as to property division, things that allow a court to accept a document, make it a binding stipulation and then proceed to other aspects of the divorce. The representation is clear, demarcated, and I believe supported by this rule. I do think that the rule preserves the ability for a trial court to keep a lawyer in under 1.16. That is fine with me because that's a measured risk. Right now, without the ability to even be clear that I have a chance of successful termination of my limited scope engagement, it is a much darker abyss for me. I prefer the safety of this rule, and I'll take that chance that I might someday be told you have to be retained in this case, and I probably would do that as a service to the court in any event. But I think this rule gives a better chance for a court to develop and see more pro bono representation. As Judge Dwyer alluded to, I will take a case appointed to a limited scope of representation. Taking a case as to the entire scope and breadth of the issues that arise in your general divorce case strikes me as a very challenging proposition and an unknown commitment of time, energy, and talent. So I think that this is a proposed rule that serves the public and it serves the profession. It will increase access to justice. It will define the boundaries of the representation, and I think all positive interests are served. Thank you.
Thank you. Steele, for the helpful information and your brevity. And the next speaker is Greg Moore, President, Wisconsin Access to Justice Commission. Mr. Moore.
Thank you, and thank you for this opportunity. The National Center for State Courts has identified limited scope representation as an important element for improving access to justice. Following is a very brief excerpt from the National Center's website. The vast majority of individual litigants cannot afford full service representation. Self-represented litigants consume a disproportionate amount of staff and judicial time. By providing quality coaching, well-drafted documents, and assisting in the more complex aspects of a legal matter, limited scope attorneys help streamline the process and reduce the burden on courts and their staff. Courts can play a critical leadership role, including in the passage of possibly needed rules changes, which I might note is essentially what you have before you, and ensuring that courts support the division of labor agreed to by client and courts. The American Bar Association has also found that limited scope representation benefits litigants. Through unbundling, lawyers have the opportunity to obtain clients who would otherwise represent themselves. Lawyers reach an untapped market and generate additional income. Clients benefit from the legal expertise of lawyers while paying only for those services that they need the most. And studies have shown that the public wants limited scope representation. In 2010, the ABA conducted a major national public opinion survey, and one set of those questions dealt with limited scope representation. 62% of the respondents indicated that it was somewhat important or very important that their potential lawyer offered this option. And that percentage scaled up as income groups lowered. 4 out of 5 respondents with incomes of less than $15,000 per year believed it was somewhat important or very important for their lawyers to offer limited scope representation as an option. And finally, the Access to Justice Commission, as you know, released a report last year entitled The State of Equal Justice in Wisconsin. Based on the 6 public hearings that were held in 2012, several fundamental themes were identified, and one of those was the continuum of legal services that low-income individuals need, ranging from access to simple forms all the way to full representation. Limited scope representation has been identified as a critically important service on that continuum. So once again, the Access to Justice Commission is supportive of this and believes that limited scope representation or the greater availability of limited scope representation, which hopefully these rules will enable, will help address what is oftentimes referred to as the justice gap here in Wisconsin. So thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Moore. And the court will be meeting with the Access to Justice Commission in April.
In a couple of weeks. Thank you.
Thank you. James Granling, Jr., Chair, Delivery of Legal Services Committee of the Access to Justice Commission. Mr. Granling.
Thank you, Chief Justice and members of the court. As the Chief just mentioned in my introduction, I chair the committee of the Access to Justice Commission that focuses on the delivery of legal services. It's natural, I think, to view the proposed rule as a great aid to people with marginal incomes. They'll be able to purchase as much in the way of legal services as they can afford. But to echo Judge Dwyer, I believe it also offers great potential to the tens of thousands of citizens in our state who simply don't have the resources to afford legal services at all. I think this is true because lawyers who serve the poor, legal services organizations and pro bono attorneys, I believe will be encouraged to devise systems which reach more clients by tailoring the legal services to each one. I can see this happening in areas that are high volume for legal services organizations, for example, landlord-tenant law, where limited scope volunteers would be in a position to help draft answers in landlord-tenant cases which raise issues of habitability, or assist clients in drafting complaints that allege violations of Rule 134 of the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. The benefit to the courts is that in so doing, the attorneys in this limited capacity will help frame the issues for the court. Trial judges deal constantly where pro se litigants are involved with trying to figure out what the issues are. And if that limited scope attorney can help frame the issues for the pro se client in a way that allows that client to enter the courtroom with at least a definition of what the issue is, I believe the circuit judge is going to be ahead of the game in terms of coming up with a fair resolution and a quicker resolution. Many good people at the state bar and elsewhere are looking at ways to increase pro bono activity, whether by written policies at law firms, CLE credit for volunteer hours, or devising ways for lawyers in government service to participate in pro bono activities. If this rule is adopted, we'll be able to put all of those new volunteer hours to work. So I join the other speakers in recommending adoption of the petition.
Mr. Granling, if you would hazard a guess how many more lawyers you get on self-represented, you can just do it in Milwaukee. Since that's your community. 10% more, 20% more, 30% more.
Well,
silly question. On the other hand, some people see this as the great savior, and others said it's marginal. Doesn't mean you shouldn't adopt it, whether it's marginal or the great savior.
I think it has the potential for reaching a significant number, and I wouldn't put a percent on it.
Right.
But it's partly in how you market it. It has to be marketed in some way, especially if you're going to encourage lawyers in private practice to volunteer their hours. You have to, as some of the speakers have suggested, show them how they'll be able to do this in a limited capacity and still have a great benefit for people in need. So I believe the potential is there.
Does the commission plan on marketing it?
We haven't discussed what active role we'll take if the petition is adopted, but there are areas in which the commission is attempting to be more active in terms of encouraging pro bono activity. And I think this would coincide, the adoption of this rule would coincide with all of those efforts, yes.
Do you see any problem with any of the provisions of these rules?
Not in terms of allowing these volunteer efforts, again, assisting existing legal services organizations to function, I do not, Justice.
You know, Justice Crooks's question reminds me that Mr. Gonring had a comment in here, Attorney Gonring of Milwaukee, and he said, and this was part of his firm's
pro bono activity. I don't know if you had a chance to
see
that.
I did read the letter, yes.
And then he said, he was bothered by something, and I'm desperately looking into what it is. Here it is. I am not enamored with the proposed statutory provisions that will require us to file a notice of limited appearance and termination of limited appearance, two forms which seem totally unnecessary and somewhat frivolous in context of his program.
Yes.
Or any lawyer for a day program. But I'm confident we'll be able to arrange a waiver. And I then looked to see if there was a waiver provision, and I didn't see it. But that doesn't mean it's not there. I just couldn't find it.
I saw that word also in his letter. I paused on it, didn't know quite what he meant, and I moved on.
So I marked it and obviously remembered it and was reminded by Justice Kirk's question. So we'll have to think about that.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you.
But that's a very special program that he's talking about. But it was one where he says, in a year we have provided representation to almost 300 victims of domestic abuse who otherwise would be unrepresented, sometimes as many as 10 in a day. That's maybe there are very many more victims, but at least these got help.
Well, it's a valuable contribution his firm has made. Yes. Justice.
Did limited scope representation ever surface in municipal court?
Not that I'm aware of. I cannot recall
the
instances where lawyers didn't do the whole thing. The whole thing in municipal court is quite easy to do. It's a pretty quick in and out or a negotiation with the municipal prosecutor.
There's a provision here that says you can do it in municipal
yes.
court specifically.
The rule extends to municipal court, and perhaps lawyers will see some way in which they can benefit by just doing a little bit of something, perhaps prepare a stipulation and a proposed stipulation and send the person to court with it, the attorney knowing that that stipulation is very likely to be accepted given the routines of the courts. So I could see that happening, and the lawyer then would not have to spend time going to court, and that could bring the cost down and allow maximization of service.
Any other comments or questions?
Thank you all.
Thank you, Mr. Gramling. Carlo Escueda, Clerk, Dane County Circuit Court.
Thank you very much, Chief Justice and Justices. I will be brief. I am here as both the elected Clerk of Circuit Court for Dane County, plus in my capacity as Vice President of the Wisconsin Clerks of Circuit Court Association. And I'm here to express our support for the petition. You know, we sort of operate outside the three points that have mostly been discussed here, that litigant-judge-attorney relationship. We're a little bit operating outside that orbit, but we do feed your system. And we are oftentimes the very first point of contact that these litigants have with the system. They come to our windows with a sheaf of papers. They are uncertain. They are fearful. And they oftentimes seize upon this human being that is their first point of contact, looking for information, looking for answers that, by and large, we can't give them. We can give them procedural information, but not legal advice. And if I had a dollar for every time that a clerk, a deputy clerk in the state of Wisconsin told a litigant that we can't give you legal advice, you should probably consult an attorney, I wouldn't be here today. I'd be on a beach somewhere. I will say that in Dane County, we are singularly blessed that we have a very robust legal resource center in our courthouse that provides materials, that provides clinics for folks to attend to get information. In fact, our librarian, Lisa Winkler, is here today. She's a godsend.
By human beings there that they can talk to.
That is correct. So all of that said, any rule or law that can be modified or created or changed to provide an incentive for attorneys and litigants to come together in a kind of relationship that is going to be beneficial to the system, is going to be affordable to the litigant, and is going to be, you know, clear to the attorney, which I've heard the attorneys seem to think that this the provisions of the petition are clear enough to them to know how to proceed. We see that as a boon to the system. We see that taking some of the pressure off the clerks in terms of, you know, not being frustrated with not being able to provide the information that folks are looking for. We'll hopefully see less of that.
How do you see this marketed? Do you anticipate that lawyers that are willing to do limited term representation will give their name to the clerk and say what area?
Yeah, it's very interesting. I know that the Bar Association does provide a resource for litigants that we give to litigants. It's a lawyer referral service. I would imagine that if the Bar Association is doing lawyer referral, that there would be an added indication as to whether these particular lawyers on the list are going to provide full or limited scope representation.
And perhaps in what area, because someone that does family law may not be interested in doing landlord-tenant law.
Right. But if the Bar Association gave me a stack of brochures that define limited scope and provided a referral service, I would gladly hand those out to litigants.
Thank you.
All right. That's all I have. Thank you.
Some bar associations have on their website lawyers who will do half hour or an hour free of charge, and also will list the hourly or project rate, and so under their referral. I don't know if the State Bar does that or the Dane County Bar does that, but it's easily accessible to the public when it's done in that fashion.
Agreed. Thank you.
Comments, questions. Thank you very much. Judge Anderson, I should ask, is there anyone here who wishes to speak on 13-10? Because I will close this after Judge Anderson speaks. Judge Anderson.
Thank you again for this opportunity. I would be remiss if I did not pass on my colleague, Mary Wolverton's support. She and I acted as the co-chair. She's suffering immensely in New Zealand right now on vacation.
Yeah. You feel sorry for her?
Yes, I felt terribly sorry for her.
Well, it's winter there.
Yes.
It's spring here, I'm told.
Chief Justice, when I left Washburn yesterday, I left behind 3 feet of snow. I can assure you that it is not spring.
There are dead daffodils underneath that snow.
Yes. Well, I would like to end with stating that I think you can see that our recommendations, you know, have the handprints of a lot of compromises that we've gone through in 4 years. We think we've addressed some pretty tough issues. We thought ghostwriting was a pretty tough issue. We thought informed consent in writing was a pretty tough issue. How to communicate with clients and attorneys that are in limited scope representation situations, that was a tough issue. I was going to bring the box of materials that we went through because it was large, I can tell you that. And one of the true joys that I have of this is we synthesized reams and reams of paper down into what we thought was the simplest type of proposal we could give to you. And I feel very confident that we've done a good job in that respect. We've tried to keep our proposals consistent with the level of integrity that we expect our profession to have. Keeping in mind that there are thousands and thousands of Wisconsinites right now who are unrepresented or underrepresented in our court system. And this proposal, we believe, recognizes the reality of life in today's legal profession. We think it allows and it will encourage both competent and affordable representation to a segment of the population that is not accessing it now. I believe it will be marketed. I think any time a profession finds out that there are perhaps 50, 40, 30% of people who are accessing something that are not helped or that there's a service out there, I think they will market it. I think they'll find a way. Judge Sherman in his support letter said to you, it's going to take a while for practices to change, and it will take a while. Our rules probably will not see a big change in the way things happen overnight. But it is, I think, our proposals give our profession a pathway that lays a good foundation to allow access to justice for those who are not getting access to justice. And I truly believe that, and the idea of access to justice and fairness for everyone should be more than just a slogan. And I think this is a true, meaningful first step, maybe not a first step, but a meaningful step in a way to allow our profession, the courts and the bar, to address this issue. Is it perfect? No. But I think it's pretty good. I would hope you would adopt it.
I tend to agree with that, but I think it's only fair to point out that Tom Cannon, the executive director of the Legal Aid Society, I'm sure you read his letter.
Yes.
That's not all right, but it's not all wrong. And that is that he opposes 1310 as it applies to poorly educated, often illiterate, or non-English speaking, and financially unsophisticated clients that the Legal Aid Society of Milwaukee represents, and says that it's a pinch of advice and to vulnerable clients. I mean, that's just one segment, not the entire segment of self-represented people. And to these kinds of vulnerable clients, it's a pinch of advice is cruel, as he says it. Compared to that, the legal action of Wisconsin, represented by Mr. Ebert, supports 1310, but did have some comments about not the petition, but the memorandum. And you might not remember that, and this is committed to staff, Ms. Rich, that he has some suggestions for the memorandum and for some changes, which I think you might, Ms. Rich might consult with you on whether they should be made. They look sort of not jugular to me, but that they may be helpful, or you may not want them. But I would suggest that Ms. Rich contact you and do that. And I'm going to make that suggestion about the waiver provision, which I didn't understand from Mr. Gonring. And the state public defender had a letter, but I think that you took care of all of the state public defender's concerns. Is that right?
That's right. Actually, the state public defender was one of the first entities to raise some concerns.
Right.
And their primary concern was the informed consent in writing, and they felt that a number of their practitioners would not be able to do that because they provide a legal service in a very narrow arena where they come in and they leave very quickly. My example was bail hearings. They provide special, they're appearing specially at a bail hearing, and they find out later that the person is not eligible for the public defender to begin with. So we exempted their office and people who are taking public defender appointments.
My recollection of that letter is that they also, however, referenced the lack of definition of limited scope representation. I hope my recollection is correct. Justice Prosser touched upon that in his questions. What, if any, response do you have with regard to that?
Well, and, you know, the Legislative Bureau actually touched on that just a little bit. And, of course, we don't believe any of the Legislative Bureau's recommendations substantially change or substantively change anything that we've proposed. I would concur with Mr. Pierce when he refers to what is an attorney-client relationship, because our code, you know, we don't have that definition within our code now. We were not asked to create such a definition. There is a definition that exists in the common law. The limited scope aspect of it, simply takes that, if there is an attorney-client relationship, the limited scope aspect of it just says, this is the scope of that attorney-client relationship, and it's just, it's put parameters to it, it's put beginnings, and it's put endings, it's what we're going to do. So I would answer the question from the standpoint that while we don't define the attorney-client relationship, we define that within the attorney-client relationship, if it does exist, and when it does exist, that there's a way to limit it and provide parameters to it. And that's what limited scope representation is.
Now, as to the business section, when I read their material, they wanted to be accepted for, as I understand it, corporate clients, but they got a much broader exception.
Yes, and we worked with the business law section on the compromise, which now is the newly created subsection E. And once we got to the heart of it, the real concern was existing clients, where a firm has, and usually it's a corporate client, whether it be a big corporation or a small family-run corporation.
Or an individual now.
Or an individual, where they routinely are providing representation form. They may not provide anything for 6 months or 8 months, but then when they walk in the door, it's time to provide representation. So we would exempt that those individuals where there's an existing attorney-client relationship or an ongoing attorney-client relationship. And once we got to that, once we realized that really was the issue from the business bar section, it was easy to solve that problem.
All right. So it's not limited to individuals. It's just prior client.
Right.
Okay. Good. All right. Thank you. Unless there are other questions, thank you, Judge Anderson.
Thank you very much.
Drive carefully, and I hope the snow is melted by the time you get home.
According to the forecast, it's 3 to 6 inches today. So, ice caves have closed, however, so do not drive up there to go wander through the ice caves. Thank you very much on behalf of our subcommittee, myself, all of the people that are here today. Thank you very much, and good luck with this.
And thank you on behalf of the court, and thank you to all the members, and I hope you will convey those thanks personally.
I certainly will.
Good.
Thank you.
That concludes our hearing in Rule Petition 13-10 in reamendment of Supreme Court Rule Chapter 20. And WSSTAT chapters 800, 801, 802, and 809 relating to limited scope representation. The court is adjourned for the day for rules hearing, and at 2 p.m. the court will meet with PPAC at the State Bar Center. We are adjourned. We will cover this hearing plus, I think we have 4 or other rules hearings, and a couple of them are combined, you're right, that the court has not made decision on but has had hearing, and I think that's on April 4. April 4 is our next rules hearing date. Everyone drive home safely, and thank you for all your participation.